Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the 100th episode of the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And as always, be sure to smash that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you all because boarding the mothership is Robert Picardo. You know him as the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager and Richard Wolsey in Stargate. He now stars in Mead and Werewolf Game. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Mr. Picardo. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure to be with you.
I'm a big fan of yours from Stargate and Star Trek and everything else you've done, even the episode of Supernatural where you played the leprechaun. You are fantastic, sir.
Thank you. That's really, I expected other leprechaun roles after that, but so far. I
unfortunately, must not be enough of them. You'll have to make a movie where you start as the leprechaun.
Well, people think of leprechauns necessarily as being short, and I think that's a very kind of prejudiced point of view. I don't think I'm too tall to play leprechauns in the future, but as I said,
I definitely hope so. You did such a fantastic job with that, especially right at the end when they spilled the salt. I'm like, you had the perfect expression on your face. I was golden.
Well, thank you. You have to remember that. We do a lot of different jobs over the course of a career. So that was 1 week, maybe 10 or 11 years ago, something like that. So I do remember that I did have to sit down and pretend to count grains of salt. So I guess the memory is still
well, like I said, so many of your roles have been sci-fi based. Like as I mentioned, you had Voyager, Stargate, Space Command. We're going to talk about Mead in a little bit. What draws you to sci-fi roles, or what is it about you that people look at you and say, this guy fits the sci-fi roles or movies?
That's a good question. I remember saying about almost 30 years ago, they're never going to cast me in a Star Trek series. So apparently I didn't think of myself as good sci-fi material, yes. But it turns out I was wrong, and I'm happy I was wrong. But I can't really tell what it is. It could just be that the enormous size of my head suggests a cranial capacity so huge that I'm perfect to play an ultra intelligent artificial intelligence. That could be it. Although I've seen other people with large foreheads floating around. I don't know what it is. I think I do think it's good in science fiction, especially if you play a character that has an awful lot of exposition. To be able to speak quickly. And I think one of the keys to the success of Voyager is that we had four very fast talkers in our cast, led by the wonderful Kate Mulgrew. Certainly Roxanne Dawson, excellent fast talker. Ethan Phillips, excellent fast talker. And I consider myself a top-notch fast talker. So when you've got 4 out of 9 characters speaking very quickly, and when Jeri Ryan joined us, she was also an excellent fast talker. So that's the key to science fiction. If you're looking to put together a science fiction series, cast me, or if you can't, cast someone of equal fast
so talking. Have you always been a fast talker, or is something you developed for the role?
That's a great question also. I think I like to speak quickly. I don't know. I mean, it's when you play a know-it-all character like the Doctor, you want to be able to get your information out as quickly as possible. So I know you asked me about me as an actor versus my character, but I think that's why he was particularly suited for it. The Doctor playing a computer program with that much programmed knowledge, when he was on his game, it would be as if he were reading from the phone book as quickly as possible, because he's simply reading off programmed information. So that's why the Doctor had to speak quickly, especially in urgent circumstances. And that's why I had to know my lines very well. Now, with respect to me, have I always been a fast talker? I think for some reason, yes, I like to speak quickly. You should see my younger daughter, though. She can speak circles around me. I think she could get jobs being a fast talker in disclaimers at the end of television commercials. But I think it's part of it is also enjoying comedy, and often in comic roles, pace is extremely important. I mean, if you want to hear some classic fast talking to your audience, if you've never seen the Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell movie, His Girl Friday, that's some fast talking. All right. So I want all of your audience to go out and watch that classic comedy. It's actually an adaptation of The Front Page, where they turned one of the principal characters from a man into a woman. But in any case, His Girl Friday, classic example. Also, I would say a Katharine Hepburn Bringing Up Baby, another excellent fast-talking movie. And this is simply if your audience wants to test their own skills against some of the acknowledged Hollywood greats.
Well, you said it, so I imagine they'll do it. I mean, a lot of our fans are Star Trek fans. So if you say it, I guarantee there's people right now on Amazon, as soon as this airs, they'll be like, find these movies. So one thing I want to do is I'm going to actually repeat a quote that you gave to the Daily Star Trek News, and I want your thoughts on it, okay? On the website Daily Star Trek News, you're quoted as saying, in regard to your support of the movie Mead, you said it's quite extraordinary. I'm happy to be part of it because you know sci-fi, there's just not enough. There's just not enough. So why is science fiction important to our culture and ourselves?
Well, I mean, there's never enough science fiction. First of all, science fiction fans are the most loyal fans in the world, particularly Star Trek fans, which is another reason for any actor, if you ever get the chance to be play a regular character on a Star Trek series, I highly recommend it, because then you will have a group of loyal fans who, for the rest of your career, will continue to be interested in whatever you do, if they like you on Star Trek. And that's an extraordinary situation that doesn't apply to other kinds of other genres. You know, if you're in a great horror movie, if you're in a or if you're on another great television series. I mean, let's put it this way: everybody loved The West Wing, but there are no West Wing conventions happening this weekend. Right. So there's something special about Star Trek. I guess it's the fact that it's set in an optimistic future, and people who love to dream of a better future are fascinated by that. Star Trek's vision of humanity's future exploring space. But it's a classic adventure series. It has high moral and ethical standards, which I think are important. And most importantly, it's positive science fiction. It's not apocalyptic science fiction. I just get a little beaten down by this, you know, the kind of science fiction where it's a post-nuclear, you know, hellscape, and there are a few scrawny stragglers, you know, scraping their way to stay alive. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, if that's your bag, watch that. But I'd rather watch something a little more
upbeat. With the knowledge that you have and all the shows that you watched, do you think the future is closer to Star Trek, or do you think it's closer to the dystopian future?
I don't think I'm going to go down on record for that, because my answer might be considered too depressing. I prefer, see, the thing that makes Star Trek so wonderfully humanist in its ideals is that science and technology empower and enable humankind without destroying it. That's the key to it, that humanity, left to its own devices, will rise to its better self, and it will use science and technology to solve problems, competition for food and resources, whatever people war over in the future. Technology will help us solve those problems, so we will not have to be constantly fighting and killing each other over territory, whether it is real estate territory, whether it is resources that people desperately need. And that is what is ultimately so positive and exciting about Star Trek. Yes, in different iterations of the franchise, in different episodes, there's always some kind of jeopardy where the galaxy is going to explode. But it's those positive Starfleet values that save the day. And those Starfleet values are simply really humankind's best aspects of our nature that are Starfleet values. So I believe in, or I hope for a future more like Star Trek. Sometimes when we're in a particularly challenging time in history, like this terrible, terrible war in Ukraine. And I heard yesterday, the Monsignor at my church saying that, and I'm sure he explored the statistic. He said there are 27 wars. I think he said 27 wars happening right now on our planet. Kind of, you know, if you look at, if you remember Carl Sagan's words in Pale Blue Dot, when we first had that vision taken from one of the Voyager spacecraft, looking back at this tiny little blue dust mote in space, known as our planet Earth, and just to imagine that all of that, that in that little dot right now there are 27 wars going on. It's sad. It's really tragic. So I hope, I root for a positive future that Star Trek embodies. And I think we can do it, but not by disbelieving in science. We just came out of 4 years of fighting science and trying to dismiss science. And when we respect science and use science as a tool and all agree on using science together as a tool, then we don't take a step back.
Now, when you look at Star Trek from the point of view of being an idealistic vision of the future, is it idealistic because the people in that future are closer to perfection, or that is that they're trying to be closer to perfection?
Well, I think what I was trying to suggest is that Starfleet takes the very best impulses in human nature and codifies them into the prime directive that, you know, you don't just step in and mess around in another sovereign planet, or by extension, another sovereign country. You don't go in and say, hey, you used to be part of the Soviet Union. Now we would like to have you back. You know, we're just going to, you're not going to be a free country anymore. You don't, you know, that's, that represents the lowest, basest form of human nature. What we're to aspire to are we are all free, that our freedom must be safeguarded. That you don't go to a sovereign planet or a sovereign country and try to impose your will on them. If they ask you for help, as is so often the case, then you try to do your best to influence whatever situation is to its most ethical and best agreed upon outcome. You don't simply, you know, pick the side that is going to give you all the dilithium crystals you need and fight on their side. You're supposed to be driven by ethical values, not commercial.
So I kind of want to go back to a little bit what you said earlier about the fact that because you're in Star Trek Voyager, you have all these fans that will follow you, correct? And also, I think...
Well, I wasn't speaking just of me. I was saying that that's a blessing that all... Star Trek actors, especially actors who played, you know, popular characters, but really all of us have loyal fans.
And like I said, you also are Dr. Woolsey in the Stargate franchise as well. When you have such...
He was Mr. Woolsey. He became a commander, but there was nothing, you know, he came from a legal background. He was a lawyer, then became a think tank guy. He was a tremendous douchebag, it should be said, Richard Woolsey, who became somewhat less of a douchebag later on, but not a very nice man early on. He had to be, what's the word? I think the writers on the show just were on a mission to rehabilitate him, and I was the benefit of that.
So when you do know that you have... these fans that know you as a particular type of character, either the Doctor or Mr. Woolsey, when you're performing other roles, do you feel that you can use that familiarity with you to kind of manipulate them, or do you find it that it's better to work against their expectations of you as an actor when you have other roles?
Well, not really. I mean, in other words, in my choices as an actor in a new performance, do I mean, it certainly influences the kind of material I'm offered, because I have a fairly loyal science fiction fan base. I tend to be offered science fiction roles, hoping that I will bring bring an audience. So that's one reason I think I get offered some of the material I do. I can't say that it influences how I choose to play the role, because, you know, that it's a whole new ballgame. It's a different character. I think, having said that, there are moments when I have winked at the audience, being in one science fiction, I've done a wink and a nod to the fact that they know me from Star Trek. For example, in one of my favorite, what's the word? It's like looking in a, it's like if you have one mirror looking into another mirror, whatever, that sort of, you know, infinite bouncing back between realities happened in a Stargate Atlantis episode in season 5 called Vegas. It took place, we are hunting for an alien who's lost in contemporary Las Vegas. That's the gag. And somebody says, well, where would you hide as an alien? Where would you hide in Vegas? Which is a funny enough joke, since you probably hide in the middle of the street in Las Vegas. But somebody said Star Trek The Experience, and then they cut to me as Woolsey, looking rather depressed, saying, no, it closed. Now, if you really are a dedicated Star Trek fan, you may know that Star Trek The Experience, the second attraction there, was based on my character, the Doctor. So I was myself a Star Trek The Experience attraction. So when you cut to me, the same actor, playing a different character, explaining in a different science fiction franchise that his theme park ride in the other science fiction franchise that he's best known for has closed, that's kind of funny to me, as you know, as far as sort of jolting you in and out of your respective realities. I've done a little wink here and there the fact that my character from Star Trek Voyager is quite well known.
So you're going to be a star in the film Mead as Admiral Gillette. How did you get involved in this film? And this film was kind of interesting because it was funded through crowdfunding, which once again is extremely risky. And the fact that you supported it even at the point before it was fully funded, it shows a dedication to the role. So what was it about this movie that you said, one way or another, I'm going to send my support this way?
That's a great question. And it's pretty easily answered. Jeff Williams is the co-writer, producer, director, and chief animator of the film. He's this like brilliant guy who sits in his basement 16 hours a day and animated the entire film. This film, he created an hour and 42 minute animated film with a couple of animated characters. Then shot all of the live action characters that were going to be embedded into the glass. So he had already worked on this project 3+ years by the time he came to me and asked me to play that role. He had Patton Oswalt as the lead voiceover character. Patrick Warburton plays a voiceover character. Among the live action cast, a wonderful actor named Sam Hunt plays really the male lead in the movie, and I play the villain character, which was fun to do. I mean, he's on a mission of vengeance. He is reading Moby Dick, and very much identifies with Captain Ahab, and the premise of the movie really appealed to me. But in answer to your question, he showed me the animation that he'd already done, as the same time he gave me the script, and so that I could see how I would be embedded in the movie. And I was so impressed with the quality of the work he'd already done on this project that I said yes. And I liked the script as well. The character is pretty much a straight ahead bad guy, but he has some fun you know, I joked that I stole one of my favorite actors, gone for some time now, George C. Scott, mm-hmm. who won the Academy Award for Patton, mm-hmm. also was great in comedy. So if you take, you know, so I took his two crazy general roles, Patton and Dr. Strangelove, where he plays I forget the name of his military character in that. But one of them, in Strangelove, he's completely over the top and crazy. And in Patton, it's completely dramatic and a little crazy too. And I just, I kind of just stole from both those performances.
That's awesome. Well, if you're going to steal from someone, George C. Scott is the one to steal from.
So, well, yeah. That's my best, you know, when you're a young actor, you don't want to say, you know, you don't want to give young actors the advice, steal from the greats, but that is the secret advice. is to at least look at great performances for ideas, especially, I mean, let's put it this way. Meet is a nice script, but it's not either Dr. Strangelove or Patton. Mm. Those are extraordinary scripts,
right?
But you could still take some of the, you know, some of the things that are memorable about it. George C. Scott had this incredible ability to scare you from the screen. There are a handful of actors that you could be in the theater 30 rows back and feel unsafe with George C. Scott angry on the screen. Not a lot of, you don't get that a lot. He could just make you kind of flinch or cringe. Anyway, I mean, there are other great actors too, but I thought of him quite a bit in shooting Mead. And as I said, the character was obsessed with Moby Dick. The premise of the movie also really appealed to me, and that I can tell you without spoiling it for anyone. It's Mead is a sentient spaceship, and he has been designed for military purposes. But then once he's created and he's sentient, he doesn't want to fight. So that's the basic premise, is that it's an artificial intelligence spaceship designed for war that refuses to fight. And my character, who is the general under whose demand this program was pursued, I'm the one who has egg on my face. I'm embarrassed and humiliated that this secret project of mine has blown up, and this sentient spaceship, very expensive, has gone rogue, and now I'm trying to capture and destroy it, mostly because of my own ego, because how dare it not obey me, because I'm the creator of the program. So and given the fact that I'm rather well known, as discussed, for playing a computer program, I'm basically playing the human bad guy who's trying to destroy a sentient, sensitive artificial intelligence. So I think that is also a source of some fun for people who know me from, you know, the other role.
Well, like I said, there's a great description of Admiral Gillette in the Kickstarter campaign itself, which is obviously the person vendetta against, like you said, Mead and Fritz. And it's described as having a treasonous pacifist who must be eliminated for the security of the planet, or actually dangerous pacifist. So I thought to myself, how is a pacifist dangerous, but how would someone like Admiral Gillette see a danger in pacifism?
Well, I mean, because his whole life and career is you know, he is a warmonger. He's sort of embodies the, you know, the military industrial complex that we talk so much about in the 60s. So he's a warrior who needs a war all the time. I'm not saying, believe me, don't think I'm saying this about our military in general. I would never do that. I have great respect for the military. But his character represents that, you know, a war hawk who wants, so a pacifist is dangerous to him because it suggests to him a state of military unpreparedness, unreadiness, that we cannot afford to risk if we have this technology that refuses to fight. But more than that, he's just, he's gone off the deep end. I mean, it's an extreme It's an extreme character, I would say. He's gone in the same way that Captain Ahab is no longer of sound mind. The closer, you know, the more he is tracking and getting closer to the great whale that took his leg. And similarly, I've lost an appendage. I won't necessarily say which one, but not from the pacifist spacecraft attacking me in particular, but by an accident that happens when I'm trying to recover the Renegade technology. I've lost a hand. Mm. So the tip of the hat or the loss of the hand is a clear, I think, Captain Ahab reference too. Mm. But at least I didn't have to fake a wooden leg. I just had to fake a mechanical hand.
So considering, like I said, all the great roles you've played, is playing a villain more fun than playing the good guy?
You know, it is fun to play villains. Often heroes are not not as dimensional as villains are, and especially in genre writing. As an example, my character, the Doctor, was certainly not a villain in Star Trek, but he wasn't very heroic early on either. And that's what made him so much fun to play, because he was a new technology, because he was designed for a specific use, which was emergency medical procedures when the regular doctor was either incapacitated or overworked. He was not designed to be a Starfleet officer first and foremost. He was designed to be a sort of an automatic come to life, you know, first aid kit. So he did not have he did not comport himself, my character, when he was newly activated, the way any other Starfleet officer would. He was not, you know, stalwart, brave, and true in every circumstance. He had all these negative qualities. He was arrogant. He was self-involved. He was cowardly sometimes. He was, you know, he had all these other negative qualities that you weren't used to seeing. And that, I think, is what delighted the audience early on, was that he could misbehave mm-hmm. so much and be just a pompous blowhard. But then as he learned and developed as a character, because he had these new subroutines that were designed to give him a bedside manner, these emotional subroutines, so that he had the capacity to learn and to empathize, supposedly, with his patients. Well, that didn't quite work out early on. Most of his feelings were directed inward toward himself rather than outward toward you, his patient. But eventually he developed and grew into a very, you know, credible, human-like artificial intelligence. And that journey from having very little affect and very few positive qualities all the way to a relatively, you know, well-rounded, quite likable, and very dependable and loyal member of the crew was what made that journey was a terrific arc. And I think if you ask any of my castmates on Voyager, my character sort of by definition had the best arc because he changed the most. He went when you start at zero, basically, you've got the farthest way to go. So, but your answer. So, I guess what I'm saying is that I have often played characters that are initially unlikable, and that you grow to like in spite of that. Whether you go back to my performance as Coach Cutlip on The Wonder Years, who's very, you know, who's like the nightmare gym teacher, who has no apparent sense of humor and kind of, you know, seems paranoid and whatever. But then my stock in trade as an actor has been to let audiences see what makes the character behave that way, what motivates Mr. Cutlip to be such a douchebag as a gym teacher. Why did the Doctor early on in Voyager, why was he so willful and snooty and paranoid about whether or not he was getting the respect that he felt the crew owed him? All of those, as you start to see what drives the apparent neurosis of the character, then the audience starts to identify with him, they start to like the character, and most importantly, they start to root for the character to be happier, to enjoy himself, to feel better in the Voyager crew to feel more like an equal. And even back to the Wonder Years, for the coach, for the gym coach to accept the fact that the kids might respect him, even if they found out he was a mall Santa, one of the famous, you know, there are all these silly, you know, situations that if the, when the audience goes, oh, now I see why he acts the way he does. And then they start to root for the character to, you know, to be more self-accepting and to be happier in his circumstances. That is a special skill I think I've had from a young actor. My early roles on Broadway, in a comedy hit that ran forever called Gemini, I played the lead in that. And then right after that, I did a play with Jack Lemmon on Broadway in the late 70s, where I played his unhappy son. What the roles had in common was that they were troubled young people who couldn't accept themselves and couldn't enjoy life. They couldn't join life until they worked out these problems. They felt they set themselves away apart from the world because they had a chip on their shoulders about something. So that is a skill that I think I understood early on in playing a character that the audience might hate and dismiss, but you had to keep the audience rooting for them, laughing at them or laughing with them, but basically rooting for them to be happier rather than just going, what a pain in the ass. I want that guy to go away.
Does Emerald Gillette have a similar arc or an arc in the story at all?
Not so much. he's pretty straight ahead crazy. The part was written to be yelling all the time, and that's tough to do. You know, nobody wants to hear a character yell all the time, but you just have to, you know, you try to find, I've done this enough where you find little ways of letting the adults in the audience. Remember, the movie is really geared for young people. I mean, I think that the core audience for Mead will be kids, you know, 12 to 16 are going to love it, but there's enough fun there for the parents to sit with them, like a classic Pixar movie, like, for example, WALL-E. It reminds me a little bit of WALL-E. Was that a Disney or a Pixar movie? Both.
Pixar, I think when it was owned by Disney, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, it's really a movie and has good, as I said, because it's about a pacifist sentient spacecraft, I think it's a fairly sophisticated idea for kids, but I think they'll enjoy that. And there's enough, my character is really for the adults. I mean, a 12 or 14 year old kid is going to see me as a straight ahead bad guy, but there's enough little Easter eggs of fun that I try to lay in there so that adults will not only look at me as the villain, but laugh at me as well.
That's very cool. So when can our listeners find Mead?
Well, Mead was at the Cannes International Film Market. It's screened there. And it's going to have, a small opening here. It's a movie that'll go primarily. My expectation is it'll go straight to streaming platforms. And it has a good company marketing the film now. And we're supposed to have, as I said, like a little mini premiere in August. But the short answer to your question is it isn't available yet. It isn't it'll be I think August 8th or 10th. I don't remember the date. So it will be available, and I'm sure we'll be on streaming platforms some later in the summer. I did my first werewolf movie. I like to, every 40 years, like clockwork, I like to do a werewolf movie, and The Howling was a while ago. So I'm in a movie called Werewolf Game. I will not tell you. It's a secret who the real werewolves in the movie are. Never know. And that was a lot of fun. Tony Todd is in that movie, who worked with me on Voyager, one of the really, really wonderful actors who's had huge success in horror as Candyman. In horror, science fiction, just a great man with a glorious voice and lovely to work with, Tony Todd, and a really wonderful cast in that movie. Also, the Chinese actress Bai Ling is in it, who has got to be the most, she looks like she's about 30 years old, but she's been working in films for 50 years, so I don't know how she does it. I did a vampire movie called Crimson Shadows. So I've done this year, a werewolf movie, a vampire movie. If I do a zombie movie, I've made the trifecta. So I'm hoping.
That sounds awesome. And Werewolf game is based on an adult game created in 1986. Mm-hmm. A game of deduction. Now, had you heard mm-hmm. of this game prior to taking the role?
No, I didn't. It had to be explained to me. And then once I took the role, I was surprised how many people had played Werewolf game. Either there's a card game based on a parlor game. My understanding is the game itself was made up in the same way charades is nobody made up charades, right? Or no, charades is just a parlor game forever. And you don't need to buy a game set of cards or whatever to play charades. Werewolf game, I understand, was basically made up by people in the 80s. If you have a large group at a party, my understanding, 12 or more, then you pass around little, pass the hat, people pull little pieces of paper, and you are either a townsperson or a werewolf hiding as a townsperson. So of the 12 people, you don't know which four are the killers. And you go around the circle and you vote at the end of every round to kill somebody. And you may be killing an innocent townsperson or a werewolf. You just don't know. So they turned that into a script. Yeah, it's not, we're not, it's very clever. That's all I will say, how the writers turned that, the idea of that game, into a very scary movie script. We're forced, not unlike Squid Game, where people are sort of abducted from life and forced to play a life and death game, whether they want to or not.
So, like I said, in the movie, there's a vote to determine who should be killed next, as you mentioned. So what are the criteria for who determine who to kill? I mean, what are the factors are they looking for? They're looking for someone who seems like they're not trustworthy, or someone who's maybe weak. Like, what is the criteria here?
You know as much as I do. I mean, that's exactly the questions you just asked are basically what we're all looking at each other trying to figure out. I mean, you really don't know. And people have all different personalities, and you can't make a, if someone is very aggressive or, pushy, does that mean they're the werewolf? Or is the quiet, kind of weak looking female who looks like, she lives at home with six cats and five plants, maybe she, because you don't know how much of it is you're being manipulated to think, to make that they're manipulating your own assumptions. You know, you would think that the werewolf maybe is the sort of loudmouth, big, beefy guy, right, who's intimidating and wants to be the person in the room everybody listens to, but you just don't know. So that's what you really ask the main question, which is you don't know whether how much of it is what you're being manipulated to believe.
It kind of reminds me of the old concept of evil, especially when they use like Lucifer. There's always two concepts, that either he's the the fire, horns, brimstone, or sometimes they show it as being the one that seems like the nicest, dressed in white, seems like the best. And evil's either this very obvious evil hatred, or the evil's far more sinister and kind of this seemingly friendly, helpful, but in reality is kind of manipulating, kind of in a way. That kind of seems to be like one of those, the classic question of what evil looks like,
No, and that's but that's what makes the movie a fun ride. I don't know. I know they had their eye on LA Scream Fest. That's the hope, is that we will that Werewolf Game will premiere the first night of LA Scream Fest in October. That's what I heard that they were gearing toward. I don't know, but that would be, I would certainly be there if it does. Part of it is, whether they get, that's a relatively narrow post-production time to finish the movie.
Now, in the without giving any spoilers away, in the actual board game, The characters include not just a werewolf, but a seer, the villager, mm-hmm. the troublemaker, and a doppelganger. Now, do these
exist? There are others, not exactly what you've said,
okay,
but there are, yes, there are other secret, there are there are other secret characters as well. Yes, that does figure into it, but I don't think they have exactly the same names.
I assume you're not allowed to say which character Bill is.
No. I can say that my character is a retired forensic detective with the Boston police. So he comes from a law enforcement background.
Now, to kind of go back to an earlier question I had about how actors and maybe directors use fan expectations of certain actors that they're familiar with to kind of flip or define mm-hmm. those expectations. When you have a character in the movie like Tony, an actor like Tony Todd, famous for horror, being a horror character, and is this something, you know, that's like a red herring, or like, you know what I'm saying? Is that something that's being used to do this?
I think it's safe. Tony Todd is not one of the 12 game players. He's sort of running things. So it's pretty clear. I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying Tony is very much a scary ringleader type character. But I will say this, to the audience that loves werewolf movies, will they bring any expectations seeing the werewolf of their youth, Eddie Quist in The Howling, to see the same actor in another werewolf movie? Is that intended to stack the deck with your expectations? What a wonderful question.
And of course, like Baylin, fans of my generation know her also from The Crow, who's definitely mm-hmm. not a good person at all. Once again, red herring, or just so happened that she's done mm-hmm. a lot of movies like this. Like, how cleverly did they cast this movie to make sure that our expectations are being flipped on us when we're watching it?
I can't answer that. You'll know once you've seen it.
Now, are we going to be able to see a werewolf in full form, or is this going to be like one of those things done in the dark?
Again, I can't answer that.
Okay. So because the movie is centered around the mystery of who the werewolf is, how does that impact your performance? Because at the one time, you're going to only play your character, but obviously you're going to leave a little bit room for people to go, is it him? So mm-hmm. How does that affect you as your performance, knowing that not only can you have to play the role of the character, but make sure it's also left mysterious of, could it be you then who is playing us as the werewolf?
I think that is a concern that all of the actors, we've obviously all read the whole script. We know what's happening, and we want as much as possible for the audience to make the full journey, which is to not know who to suspect. So I would say, yes, that is something you give thought to, but the script is also, I think I can also, my character is kind of a father figure and trusted more than most of the characters off the bat by a number of other characters. So the question is whether that trust was well placed mm-hmm. or not, is what it boils down to.
It also seems to be a question of morality. Once again, if they're voting correctly, they correctly killed a werewolf, congratulations, you're good people. If they voted incorrectly, they're moral asses who just murdered an innocent. How much is this an effect?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. And they don't, and people, everybody's the group decision is a moving target. It's changing. And then suddenly they have to push the button and make the decision. And people, you know, some people decide right away. Some people waffle like crazy. Some people, you know, everybody in the urgency of that moment, of having, you know, it's either I'm going to get killed, if I don't make a decision, then I could get killed myself. So I have to, you know, it's people, it's in a terrible, impossible situation. It's funny, I started watching Squid Game because I'd heard a lot about it. Mm-hmm. Right after I shot Werewolf. Yeah, and then I realized how much you know, that this, I don't think, had Squid Game not come along and been such a big success, then would a movie like Werewolf Game get made? Because some of the premise, it's completely different, but the basic premise of randomly pulling people out of their lives and forcing them to play a life and death death game, that it has in common. So you know, so it's in the ether, and that could be just, you know, that could be part of pandemic paranoia, right?
Mm.
You know, we're all in a time, I mean, especially early on in COVID, where it seemed like life was Russian roulette for a while there, you know? And I think that the culture responds to that with their choices in escapism movies. Mm. Yeah.
Now you said the characters are picked randomly. How random is it? Are they picked because for some reason that they're known to have maybe something that they're trying to atone for, or is it truly random?
That's a good question. I believe it's truly random, and yet you find out little bits about each of them. So this, what you said about atonement or possible atonement, I think that I don't think that that's how they were selected, okay. But I think the irony of their situation with a lot of the characters will be the audience will come to understand that.
Would the motivation then be purely self-preservation, or is there a moral component of let's make sure we're doing the right thing, let's make sure we're killing the werewolf, or is it true self-preservation and what comes if it comes of it?
I would say that it's all those things, but it depends on the nature of the person. I would say that different people you realize in retrospect were motivated by higher ideals than others.
Mm.
But that's it. I've given you enough clues. That's it.
Well, I'm going to have one last question on this one. Since you were obviously in this movie, did you think to yourself or any time contemplate what you would have done in that situation yourself as Robert Picardo?
Oh, I hate questions like that. One of the great things about, you know, it all being make-believe is that we have to behave under those imaginary circumstances as if it's absolutely real. But we're not playing ourselves. We're playing a character. So we don't really have to look, you know, in the, and go, oh my God, what would I actually do? I have created a character, and I know how he responds because he comes from a very different background than I do. So I hate that question, but I would probably, I don't know. I mean, I like to think I would be one of the ones who would be unwilling. In the case of the movie, if you're unwilling to pick someone, you just get killed early. So I might not be, let's put it, I might not have survived that long myself in these circumstances.
Or you would have been the werewolf.
I would have been the werewolf, exactly, because of my past history and training.
like Mr. Picardo, it sounds like a fantastic movie, and I do look forward to it coming out. And is it going to be theater release, we think, or is it going to be streaming as well?
I hope so. You never know. These movies, they're made with, they have financing and they have a marketing plan. They don't have a distributor before they're made, and that works sometimes can really work in your favor if the finished movie, when they do screen it, as I said, if we were to get into a nice horror festival like LA Scream Fest early on, then that would determine a screening like that would determine how the movie is released. So I can't really answer. I don't know.
Well, like I said, it sounds fantastic. And so does, and me sounds fantastic as well. So I just want to thank you so much, sir, for talking with me about both movies. And hopefully when the next one's out too, you come back and we talk about those as well.
All right. Thanks. That'll be great.